And joining us now in studio, well, of course, I already told you Buck was here, so he didn't have to join me. He was already here.
It's disappointing, I know.
But. Well, no, no. And along with Tom Supernaut and Lonnie Dupree, who the three of them make up at least what has come to be known as the Arrowhead Expedition. As I mentioned earlier, these fellows just recently summited Mount Denali and also made it back down. And I did hear, you know, I was so impressed when hearing about this whole trip until I was listening to Buck on the feature this morning, and he mentioned that there was an escalator up there.
Oh, he gave it away.
Just took the escalator back down. No wonder you get down in 3 days.
It was a rough escalator. It only had every other step.
At any rate, welcome to the two of you. Welcome to Buck, too, but he's supposed to be here.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, in thinking about this whole thing, I guess I've just really got one question about the trip. Why?
Well, I think we're
and
all
I'm only
there.
And I'm only half kidding, by the way.
I think we're all there for a little different reasons. Buck has too, and Tom probably as well, but I've always admire mountaineers and always wanted to understand that a little bit better, I guess, compared to some of the polar expeditions and stuff that I've done in the past. And so I learned that there's a whole lot less oxygen when you get up high, and it's a lot harder to drag stuff. But it was a challenge for me, and I was way out of my comfort zone on several occasions. And I think we probably all were, but it was really, really hard. But the scenery was some of the best views I've ever seen in my life. And
now, how did the whole idea come about? I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing for an individual to have, well, okay, boy, sometime I'd like to do something, but how did, and originally, and I want to ask about that, but originally there were four of you. How did the whole thing come together?
Well, this early in January, Lonnie stopped by and said, what do you think about climbing Denali? And I'm just going, that sounds very interesting. And I know Lonnie and Buck had previously talked about it, and so they were looking for another guinea pig to go on the trip.
Needed another back.
And I said yes, and really didn't understand or really realize what I was getting into. You can read the books, you can go online and look at the pictures, but until you're there, you can't grasp the largeness of it.
Buck, what once you decided, all three of you, along with, you know, you had a fourth gentleman, a doctor from Duluth. I don't recall his name, but
Steve Pitchka.
And unfortunately, Steve, at about 11,000 feet, developed
pulmonary edema,
which is retention of water, and it was in his legs, and it can be a very, very dangerous situation. So you went down to 3,000, took him back to 3,000 feet, and then the three of you continued on. But once you made the decision, what kind of training do you go through? How do you decide, I'm going to train to climb to 17,000 feet?
Well,
particularly living where we do.
You know, Lonnie and I had been talking about a different project that we were thinking of doing, and that didn't happen. And we had this space of time, particularly Lonnie, where, hey, let's do something. And we'd been talking about Denali for, a couple years maybe.
Yeah, been
at different times.
A couple.
Yeah. So he said, well, let's climb Denali then. I mean, we got the time. So, okay, let's go try to do that. And I think, as many folks out there, you know, you're always looking for a challenge, something new to do, something that's going to push you a little bit, so that it's just like the reason that people go camping. You go camping to get back to nature, to get back to simple life. And much of what you do in the outdoors is like that. But this also includes a challenge for people who are athletically inclined or just need that extra push to bring a lot of real life into their life, and that's kind of why you do it. You go out there and challenge yourself and push yourself. And
the difference is, camping, generally you're not putting your life at risk. Well, at least not like you are on this kind of
challenge part of it. The outdoor part of it is camping.
Well,
we were camping for 2 weeks straight, you know, and winter camping is, I mean, Lonnie shines 100% there, boy, I tell you, because he's done more winter camping than anybody I know, and also cooking, and that's a big part of it, mm-hmm. is you got to want to be out there, outside. If you're not happy outside, you're not going to be happy on Denali, because
And you have to be happy outside at pretty cold temperatures.
So at colder temperatures, uncomfortable places, and living in a tent.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So Lonnie, once you decided to do it, and how did you train? I mean, what did the training? Obviously, you can't acclimate yourself to altitude because we don't have it.
No, you'd have to go somewhere like out to Rainier or something and climb some 14ers, mm-hmm. which would get you up to 14, of course. But acclimatizing doesn't stay with you. You know, I couldn't go out there like a month before.
Right.
It would have to be like days before. Mm-hmm. How we trained for it is we basically went you. Pretty much when you're training for whatever it may be, whether it's doing a polar expedition or skiing or what have you, try to simulate what you're going to be doing on the expedition. So for what we did is we knew we would have to carry heavy packs and have to be going uphill, of course. And so what we did,
of course.
Well, actually, I mean, when I say going uphill, actually going down can be worse.
I'm sure, yeah.
But we started with you know, a few salt bags from mm-hmm. Buck's Hardware in the backpack and increased those every couple of weeks until we got up to about 65 pounds in our packs, and we hiked probably anywhere from a couple to two to four miles. Sometimes every day, sometimes uh-huh. every other day, and we might have mixed. I know I mixed it up with a little running, Buck with a little biking, Tom with a little running, and so that's what we did, and kept it up for about 4 months.
Four months, I guess.
Tom, when you were on the expedition, you had packs, but you also were pulling sleds, right?
Yeah, on the lower half of the mountain, we had to pull sleds with all our gear. Uh-huh. So up to, was it 11,000?
11,000.
Yeah, 11,200. So we had 60-pound packs and then probably 60-pound
actually,
sleds.
Actually, 14,200, yeah. We had sleds to 14,200.
Oh, so then after that, you've just got your backpack. I don't mean just, but you're not pulling the sled after that. Is that right?
Right.
One question I've gotten, and it probably applies to other things too, do you just leave your sled there, or do they have a place where check your sled?
Actually, you would cache it with your food.
Okay.
Because basically you end up climbing the mountain twice, where you go up, cache your food, and then sleep low. So you climb high, sleep low.
Buck, and that's a fascinating thing to me, is that you climb up to a certain altitude, that's done, you leave your food, now you go back down, maybe a couple thousand feet, to sleep.
Yeah.
So then you get up in the morning, and you got to go up 3,000 feet to get your breakfast.
Well, you can't carry it all at once.
Yeah.
You can try, uh-huh. and we did. and when you know, when we went from 7,800 feet to 11,200 in one push, we learned later from some of the guides that nobody does that.
Oh, is that right?
Everybody carries a load up, comes back down, and then carries another. So, but we had some extenuating circumstances there with the whiteout and fog, and we just missed a camp. But at any rate, as you move up the mountain, that's what you do. You just don't want to carry, you know, 110 pounds in your pack, or mm-hmm. even attempt that mm-hmm. so early on. So you'd bring food and fuel up, come back down and sleep, and then you move your camp up, mm-hmm. or you have a rest day.
Well, you know. How far, you know, and I listened to the three of you talk, and, you know, you move from 11,000 to 14,000, or how far is that in, take a tape measure and, take a hip chain and measure it off. Now, how far is 1,000 feet going up the mountain?
The entire expedition horizontally is, what, 15 kilometers? Is that right, Buck?
No, it's actually further than that. We went almost 6 miles our first day and then 5-something the second day.
Okay.
But then it got shorter and shorter because it's steeper.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So most of it's vertical feet.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Most of it's vertical. And so even though the distance isn't that far and we can do that something like that in a half an hour here, it's actually, you know, a very, very long
oh,
day.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not
minimum. Yeah.
And I think that must also be demonstrated along with, as you mentioned, almost like leapfrogging your packs. Why it takes you 3 weeks to climb it in 3 days.
Well, when you're running on a very short amount of oxygen, you are taking a step, breathing twice, and then taking another step and breathing twice. It's rest stepping and then breathing.
And I don't assume time you're doing, there's a lot of conversation going on.
No.
Not a lot of, look at that.
Especially when, you know, when we're going up the glacier and we're roped together and we're approximately 50 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of alone time as you make your way up.
Buck, I want to talk about that because when you're going across the glacier, you've got these deep, deep crevasses. And then you got snow bridges, and that's what you use to get across them. And unfortunately, and it happened to you guys. You fell through the crevasse. To have three of you in a row, you're pulling sleds, because you had sleds then. You're roped together, and like Lonnie said, you're doing this rest walking. Boy, you really got to be kind of not only conscious of what you're doing, but conscious of what the other two guys are doing, aren't you? I mean, you really have to be kind of be in concert.
It's a team.
Yeah.
And yeah, you do, and you have to keep the rope tight.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have a lot of slack in the rope and somebody goes in, they can go in a lot further.
Oh, sure.
Than if there's if it's a tight line. And the guy on the end of the rope also has a sled behind him that's not tied into the rope. It's a little more difficult there because the sled wants to catch up to you.
Oh, sure.
Or run into your legs or doesn't go straight or goes sideways. And it was really... really difficult on the lower glacier as we were leaving, but it does take a lot of concentration. And to be honest with you, we had one day of training for roping up together and for crevice rescue.
Yeah,
and
that's not a lot of training for a month long trip.
I don't think it's recommended. No. But that's just what we had time
I would say some training is recommended, but probably
it was intensive and it was good training.
Yeah,
but it's hard to keep that all together. There's a lot of things to remember.
And you did wind into a situation. I know that, Tom, you went into one or two crevasses, and you went into Buck, and you guys were having a difficult time getting them out of there.
Yeah, I was...
You were the last guy, right, Buck?
I was the last guy and third guy on the rope.
Yeah. And I wanted to be real clear right now. You never thought of cutting the rope.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I did look back at Tom and he was fiddling for something, but I didn't know what it was.
Easy to make me light of it. Buck's the one that's dangling there.
You want to try to keep the rope tight. I was out front trying to pick our way through this stuff, and what appears safe to get across. At one time, the second person could put a ski pole through. The third person could go through altogether.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you just try to pick the best route you can through all the stuff. There's lots of crevices, not just one or two. They're around you all over. And so when Buck went through, at first, I don't think Tom and I were quite aware if he went through or not. We looked behind. It was kind of foggy. There was snowing. It was snowing a bit. And we really didn't know for sure. And I kept yelling at Tom, did Buck go through? Did Buck go through?
Let me interrupt you. How much rope between 50 feet? Between?
That's a good approximation. Okay. It was a little further.
So couldn't you feel it?
Well, no, because the angle of the when you go straight into a crevice, there's not that much tugging on you. Because the lip of the crevice has taken up some of the strain. But when we finally realized that it was through, Tom and I both pulled, and we both pulled so hard, just straight ahead, that it actually lifted our sleds right off the ground, because our sleds are also connected to the line.
Sure.
And we realized how difficult it was to try to get Buck out that way. And luckily, there was another team just passing us on the trail. And there was a lead skier in that team that just happened to be up a little closer to the crevice.
Were you on skis at this time?
We were all on
crampons.
Crampons. Yeah. And that guy was able to assist us, and Buck managed to wiggle his way out.
Because I don't assume at that point in time, Tom, that there's any way for the two of you to say, well, here, let's unhook the sleds and let's, you don't have that kind of...
No, we didn't have any of that. Listen. And in the training that we had, if that other team hadn't been there, we'd have had to go into trying to set up some rigging and some pulley systems to get Buck out, because the two of us brute force, couldn't Buck out. He's got a 60-pound pack on. He's got a sled hanging off his butt, and it's dead weight.
No, but there's a good reason, though, for that is because we were going downhill, and they're downhill from me. There's no way with that angle they could pull me out. No. There's no way. The angle is just... Because the angle's like this, and I'm down here.
Buck's showing this. On
yeah, it's downhill. Think of it, you know.
Okay, so you were going downhill at the time, not uphill.
And I'm the last guy.
Right.
So we were just in a bad position. I mean, they were trying with all their might, but the rope, all they're doing really is putting pressure against the rope.
So what's the rope connected to? Do you have like a harness? Are you wearing like a harness?
Or is it connected? I hooked it to my big toe. It was the most sensitive spot, that I could use. No, actually, it's hooked to your harness.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then it's hooked to then the sled. So the rope coming from Tom's sled, for instance, who's in the middle, is hooked to your harness?
Tom's sled is hooked to the main rope. Now, in the case of my sled, because I'm the last guy and it's behind me, it's not hooked to the main rope.
Right, right. So you go through, and I don't want to dwell on this, but you go through, you drop 3, 4, or 5 feet, you're in a crevice that could be, you don't have any idea how deep, hundreds of feet deep.
A big crevice. It's one of the main crevices in that area, and we had just thrown some material, what's called a clean mountain bag, in there. It's a biodegradable unit to get rid of some of your human waste.
Oh.
And it's big.
Huh. Yeah, it's a Bergeron.
You're hanging.
So it's a main part of where the crevice drop, or where the glacier drops off the edge of a mountain. It creates one of the biggest crevices right in the beginning, which can be several hundred feet deep.
Yeah. So you're hanging there.
Yeah.
And they're trying to pull you, and you're not making any progress.
I'm 3 feet. Below
And the sled is dangling from you, too. What's going through your mind?
Well, really, you're just thinking about, what can I do to improve my situation? You know, and that's all. You're not scared. You don't have time to be afraid, you know. I know they're pulling because I can feel it. And my first thought, of course, is not what I learned in class. It's grab the rope and pull yourself out. Well, there's no way you're ever going to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And we had made a few errors along the way, and you always do when you're new at something. And so the fact that this additional climber came and changed the angle by grabbing near the crevice lip is what really popped me out. And I mean, plus the great force that those guys are putting against the...
The three of you, I want to remind folks, we're visiting with Tom Supernaut and Lonnie Dupree and Buck Benson, who recently returned from summiting Mount Denali. But Buck, you've done some climbing. Lonnie, yours has been more expedition
I've
type.
Done some stuff. Glacier travel in Greenland.
And I'm not too sure, Tom, I mean, the three of you basically at this type of thing are kind of novices. A little bit new to you.
We're not mountaineers, no.
Right, and you elected not to have a guide. Why?
Well, I've learned that Denali can be climbed if you have patience and you know how to winter camp. I had a lot of Arctic experience, so I figured if we could take care of that end of it, we would get some training prior to it. We like Buck has been up high. I've had some training in crevice rescue, some knot work, some rope work. Tom has done lots of marathons, so we had a good healthy team. Steve Pitchka was a doctor on there, so we thought we had most of the bases covered. And if we ever got to a point where we felt like our lives were at too much of a risk, we could always stop.
Tom, it sounds like in talking to the three of you and also reading that article that the trip was a lot more difficult and you did feel that you had your lives at risk more than you anticipated. Was there ever a time when you thought, let's just turn this bus around and head back home?
Not really. I think we had probably when we were on our summit day, which took us 19 hours, at about 19:05, we made a decision at the time to drop our rope and go unroped to the summit. And I think there was some discussion, you're tired, you're at 19.5, your brain isn't totally there with a lot of lack of oxygen. I personally didn't have that. No, I'm not going to, I'm going to turn this bus around. I just going to say, I'm going to go as far as I can and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And making a conscious decision not to use the rope on the summit was, I think, at that time, our paces were a lot different. Lonnie was stronger. Buck and I weren't quite as strong. And managing that rope to keep it, keep the slack out, not get it hooking your crampons, I think would have been more dangerous for us than not. Mm-hmm. And so we decided not to rope and
the,
did it.
Yeah, the summit ridge is it varies in width, but it's about 2.5 feet wide. And so if you got dangling rope there, you could get caught in
sure.
it. You're better off just being able to keep your balance.
Well, Buck, obviously there's other people on the mountain. I mean, one, fortunately, there was at least one other group that helped you pull you out of the crevasse. But so what are the chances? Okay, you go up and the three of you, different paces, but the three of you are at the summit. And now you decide to start coming back down. You got to come down that same narrow ridge that you went up. Mm-hmm. What's the chances you're going to meet somebody? And what happens if you do?
Well, you'll see somebody coming. You know, you can find a spot for them to go by. It's not that busy. Where
no, I'm sure it isn't, but there are other people there, obviously.
There's other people.
But you don't run into them that much? Or
there was a group that summited before we started up that summit ridge in, mm-hmm. on the hill before is where we met them about. That was the only people that were that high at that time.
Oh, I see.
I suppose there could have been, you just have to be aware when other people, you can see other people
sure.
on the ridge and
sure.
you know, you have to be aware, but.
There's a window where, when of time when you can do this, right? I mean, you don't do Denali any time of the year, you know,
And we had basically from the end of April till the middle of July is kind of the window this season, and we chose June because the weather looked most favorable, and it also looked like in the past more people had summited during that period than the other periods, and I didn't want to be out there at 50 below, which you can find in end of April, first part of May.
Sure. Sure.
I just don't like it when it's that cold. So,
as opposed to Lonnie, who was hoping it would
yeah,
get that
cold. Yeah, he kind of was hoping.
Would thin things out a little bit up on the ridge.
Yeah, quite a bit.
So Buck was telling me, Lonnie, that at some point in time you were, I don't know if that was coming down or going up, but you were traveling at night, which of course really isn't, it's not really dark because you got 24 hours of daylight. But
yeah, I mean, like Tom said, it took us 19 hours to do on summit day from the time we left the tent to the time we got back. And so we actually reached the summit about midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was plenty light out, although the sun is just getting below the horizon just a little bit before that, but still plenty of light.
At other times we were traveling at night because the weather got warm.
Well, we try to travel at night, especially lower on the glacier, because one, the snow softens up and makes those snow bridges across the crevices quite weak.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to travel during the cool periods. Plus, it's more comfortable to travel when it's cool.
Are you able, Tom, to see the ridge or the bridges as well if you're traveling? And I mean, I understand that it's light, but it's not the same kind of light as when the
You can see the bridges across the crevices, especially when we went down from the time we left and the time we got back in the lower glacier. The bridges sink down.
Oh.
So you'll be going along and you'll see this depression of a foot to 2 feet and then come up. So, you know, it's like, okay, here's a snow bridge, and you kind of get up to it and scoot across
it. I see. Scoot meaning
yeah really quickly.
Well, and I think I know the answer to this question too. Clearly it was, you know, obviously you all pushed yourselves certainly close to your limits, more than you thought you were going to have to. Is it something that any of you or anything like it would ever do again?
Would we do that again? Not that mountain. But I think everybody has to speak for themselves, I guess, on that question. But it took me 3 or 4 years to forget the last one.
Mm-hmm. And your health wasn't all the good after the last one.
You know, really, we've talked about this between us, and we've also heard a lot of information up there, but the last one I was on was about 23,000, and that is higher. Mm-hmm. You do feel the altitude more. You feel it more camping at 19.6 than you do. And, of course, when you're down there, they're telling you, well, it's drier. It's really like 26,000. Then you're on Denali, and they're saying, well, because it's further north, it's really like 23,000. But actually, that, you know, the altitudes do mean something. And it was tougher for me the previous time dealing with that higher altitude.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I shouldn't say that. It was harder to deal with the altitude. There was a lot more work on this mountain. This was a lot more dramatic, a lot bigger mountain, a lot more of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. You're going to line it up again for next year?
Well, I did it because well, I used to live in Alaska, and I've seen the mountain several occasions, and I just wanted to learn more about what kind of goes through the heads of a mountaineer.
Mm-hmm.
When they're
and it's, why am I doing this?
Yeah, it's more like, gee, I wish I could breathe right, and you know.
One last question, and I don't mean, I'm not going to pin you down on it, but for those who are listening who are thinking, I'd like to do that. Maybe instead of going to Aruba next year, I'll do that. Put it in cost-wise in terms of I mean, because it's a long time. You were gone for a month, weren't you?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Okay. Yeah. In terms of a normal vacation to Mexico or something like that.
Well, I mean, I you got the time off. Of course, you got four months of training that you have to do.
Right.
There's no question. You can't just jump on the mountain for sure.
No.
And you got the time away, and you need to really figure a month. And it can be, it depends on whether or not you get a guide or not, but it'd probably run you around $5,000-$6,000, you know, mm-hmm. dollars to, if you had a guide.
Yeah.
Yeah. To do that too. So you got the time
There's
away.
There's that too. Yeah. Well, it is really a fascinating story. And most of all, I'm just thrilled, and everybody is, that the three of you are back. And it is something I'm sure that the three of you will remember for the rest of your lives. And it's kind of fun for the rest of us to be able to share it with you too. So thanks very much for coming in and,
sharing
the story.
Yeah, thanks, Buck.
It was great.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, it was a great, I got to see a photo that Tom had blown up yesterday, and it's pretty dramatic, and it kind of brings it all back to see something like that again.
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
Just one thing. I think we all started as friends, and we're still friends, and that was...
That's a pretty good deal, too.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're spending, as I understand it, the tents are not exactly spacious, so... to have
Buck and I shared
those kinds of quarters, and to be through that kind of stress, I think, and still be sitting in the same room is a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
So thanks guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.